Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 97, section 9, got about halfway through the section, which is on old single column, page 1073. It's the 17th paragraph. It's the paragraph that starts out, "By this time, Yahweh's temple." Right after the paragraph that's set off by large paragraph breaks, the one about Solomon. Remember how we ended with his harem numbered almost 1,000?
memory aid.
Yeah, not to mention all of his other excesses. You know, all that stuff that was there with the temple of Yahweh. You know, if you look in that paragraph, remember there's the house of Lebanon that's there. Jerusalem too, the palace of Pharaoh's daughter. You know, the king's palace, etc. All that really fancy stuff that was right there in Jerusalem. Not to mention all kinds of other stuff. You know, we're going through this section, this long section on Hebrew history. And we made it through to the 10th century there, 10th century BC, with Solomon, after whom the United Kingdom broke up into two kingdoms, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. But remember, even before that official kind of breaking into two kingdoms, there was always very stark difference between those, you know, basically to the north of Jerusalem and those to the south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem ending up being the capital, you know, David making that the capital, he's staking a claim, pardon the pun with the Baalites and stuff, he's staking a claim, sort of right in the middle between the northern peoples and the southern peoples, between Ephraim in the north, remember that how they, you know, described it that way, and Judah in the south. Ephraim proper, you know, is that area, that hill country that's just immediately to the north of Jerusalem. So obviously, if we got to Solomon, they took us through all the machinations with Saul and David and all that, and recall that what this is all about. You know, we should maybe just go back to that tiny little preface paragraph at the end of section 8, you know, that preceded this Hebrew history paragraph, where it said, "A brief recital of the high points in Hebrew history will illustrate how the facts of the record were so altered in Babylon by the Jewish priests as to turn the everyday secular history of their people into a fictitious and sacred history." So the point is not, you know, this, you know, what it might appear simplistically by the title of the section, to give you, you know, all the details of Hebrew history over those centuries. It's just to hit a few high points to illustrate, you know, how things were reworked to produce basically, in many ways, a propaganda document for the Jewish people in exile to try not to be so disillusioned about their state of affairs. You got all these very devout Hebrews dotting every I, crossing every T, supposedly Yahweh is demanding of them, and And there, you know, and that's supposed to produce all of this material prosperity, and yet, you know, they're constantly being besieged by greater powers, and you know, and hauled off into exile and what have you. And so, you know, they were trying to, you know, the priests were trying to give the people something to hold on to. And even though, you know, when they said they're fictitious, you know, in sacred, in quote unquote sacred history, you know, obviously, even though, you know, factually it's fictitious, there's nonetheless a thread of truth to the priests taking the facts of their history and sort of making the hand of God be a very overt external affair. There's a measure of truth to them being a chosen people, like we've talked about, that you know, God's hands, the Melchizedek receivers and others, have definitely been working with these people to try to foster an inner life. You know, they've been chosen to get extra special help, the kind of help that normally the planet overt a planetary administration would give all of us, right? Yeah, to get some extra help to hold on to enough of an inner light of recognition that there's at least, you know, little threads of truth in their culture that the incarnate Michael can take a hold of and try to nurture up into ever greater recognition, you know, as a spiritual uplifter. So, you know, on the one hand, we're being really tough on them for their reworked, you know, fictitious history here, but you know, we don't want to ever lose sight of the fact that it's not some sort of bizarre coincidence that there were all these genuine prophets amongst these people. They were being very aggressively and repeatedly engaged to try to get them to stay between the lines a little bit. All right, but as we read through the rest of the synopsis of their history, you know, we'll see yet again that, you know, you could send a new genuine prophet every 5 minutes, you know, and you couldn't keep them on track for more than, you know, those 5 minutes. They immediately veer off on a tangent if given the slightest opportunity. So let's look at this. What happens now as things split up really into these two official, you know, northern and southern kingdoms? You know, remember particularly we saw this ever growing influence of the Judahites, you know, those in the south, you know, pushing the northern culture down. Remember how it said Solomon purged the political machine of all northern influences there? Right, so, you know, how's this going to play out for the people in the north? You know, so that's who they'll give us first, kind of the same way that we looked at the prophets in the north and then we looked at the prophets in the south. So we'll look at the history in the north first and see what these people sort of do with themselves in the wake of Solomon.
By this time, Yahweh's temple at Shiloh was discredited, and all the worship of the nation was centered at Jabus in the gorgeous royal chapel. The northern kingdom returned more to the worship of Elohim. They enjoyed the favor of the pharaohs, who later enslaved Judah, putting the southern kingdom under tribute.
Okay, quick little look forward there at the end. But, okay, so step one is, as I mentioned in the preceding paragraph, you have, quote-unquote, the first temple. You have, you know, Solomon's temple, as they described it there, the temple of Yahweh that Solomon built. And so this means that that kind of primary location, you know, immediately to the north of Jerusalem, Shiloh, remember how you had the primary one to the south, Hebron, about the same distance to the south as Shiloh is to the north. Yahweh's temple there in Shiloh was obviously going to, you know, evaporate, you know, in terms of, you know, not being able to live up to the fanciness of what Solomon has constructed there in Jerusalem. Or as, you know, remember, it's, you know, it slowly evolves into be calling Jerusalem. We're still kind of in the mode, you know, as they're saying there, you know, we're still kind of being called Jabez in many ways. You know, and so they, when they say centered at Jabez in the gorgeous royal chapel, again, that's Solomon's temple. The interesting thing, again, is, you know, that just like in Jesus' time, when you had so much greater Greek influence in, you know, the northern parts, you know, like Galilee and, you know, and thereabout, you know, that kind of more, less isolated, more connected to the outside world, more cosmopolitan sort of flavor, that that more ancient God concept, it's going back to Andite influences and whatnot with the, about the Trinity, Elohim, that's going to gain, you know, gain some street cred again in the north. You know, you can see they enjoyed the favor of the pharaohs. You know, like I was just saying, that, you know, that relationship with external powers. You know, even to the point where eventually you've got you know, Judah, the southern kingdom, being under tribute. So the there were moments when those in the north, you know, got a little bit of compensation, if you will, sort of for their pride of kingdom, you know, over the southern kingdom. But I think, as everyone knows, the northern kingdom falls first. You know, so I mean, that's kind of one of the main reasons to talk about the northern kingdom first, is they, you know, they fall to the external powers before the southern kingdom does. All right, so all right, so that's the stage. Now they're going to mention there's a dynasty that gets set up in the north, that you know, has some non-biblical historical fame. Right, when the foreign powers are writing about their doings, the House of Omri or Omri, you know, is part of those records. So you're going to set up this kind of a dynasty in the Northern Kingdom initially here that they're going to talk about.
There were ups and downs, wars between Israel and Judah. After 4 years of civil war and three dynasties, Israel fell under the rule of city despots who began to trade in land. Even King Omri attempted to buy Shemer's estate. But the end drew on apace when Shalmaneser III decided to control the Mediterranean coast. King Ahab of Ephraim gathered 10 other groups and resisted at Karkar. The battle was a draw. The Assyrian was stopped, but the allies were decimated. This great fight is not even mentioned in the Old Testament.
All right, so there were some big battles that went on, like they're mentioning, that you know, didn't make it into the to the reworked story, because it just, you know, wasn't really anything that the priests thought that, you know, was necessary that they could play off of there. But you've got this key character, Shalmaneser III, the Assyrian king. So now you remember how Assyria is further north in Mesopotamia. You know, way down in the south, you have, you know, what was Sumer, Chaldea, and then kind of more Babylon as you move up between the rivers. And then as you kind of go straight north, following more the Tigris up, you know, rather than the Euphrates, it starts to veer off to the west. Following, you know, up there to the north, that's where Assyria was. So you have a seat of power kind of more in the north of Mesopotamia that is controlling things for a while. Before there's this Babylonian revival, in other words, a revival of the people a little bit further to the south in Mesopotamia. But initially, see, the northern kingdom is dealing not with Babylon, but with Assyria. Yeah, that's the deal. You've got the famous King Ahab there, you know, as part of the house of Omri. Who is Ahab's famous wife? Jezebel. The name that everyone knows. The only reason I kind of quizzed you there is, you know, you want to remember how not that long ago in the United States, it was much more obvious that one of the main reasons that we started public education in the country was so everyone could read the Bible. Because everyone really did know the Bible stories. In many ways, the Urantia book is written with the assumption that you have a basic understanding of the Bible stories that basically even the commonest person not that long ago knew. Everyone knew all the basic stories. It's not like now where people make it all the way through college and they can't even point to the United States on a globe. Okay. I mean, we're so hopelessly ill-educated. Just keep that in mind that, you know, you're kind of expected a little bit to appreciate some of these references. They're not going to spoon-feed everything to you every time.
Was Israel the northern and Judah the southern?
Yeah, Israel's the northern, Judah's the southern.
And as far as we're concerned, it's not that much, it's not that far north, so to speak. It's just right. Not that far from apart from each other.
Yeah.
In terms of today's travel times.
Yeah. But we all know to this day, you've got peoples that think of themselves as an infinite distance apart, and, you know, and you can literally throw a stone, you know, over their whole lands, you know. Right? How much it's kind of like some of the principality parts of Europe, you know, where every hill is its own little, you know, principality into itself, and you hate the people, you know. 2 miles, you know, away on the next hill.
Right.
So you have that very, circumscribed mentality definitely there. That big battle at Karkar and everything, you know, that's stuff that's definitely part of our history that we haven't lost.
Even though it's not mentioned in the New
Testament. Even though it's not in the Old Testament, it's mentioned in, you know, Assyrian records, okay. You know, for instance. So we know all about those battles and stuff. But remember what they're saying, you know, even King Omri attempted to buy Shemer's estate. So, yeah, remember, that's the big thing. You know, we're going to be bringing in Elijah and stuff here shortly. That whole conflict between the Yahwehites and the Baalites, that whole bit about land ownership, you know, whether or not you You think that no one can own the land, you know, thus saith Yahweh, the God of the desert, nomads, or whether you go with Baal, the god of the mentality of the more settled city dweller sorts of people that need, you know, private ownership of land and whatnot, and a settled, you know, estate, you know, pardon the pun, you know, you needed that sort of a settled estate sort of mentality. Okay, so so that's that's what gets set up, that whole House of Omri phenomenon is going to be kind of ruling things for a while there in the Northern Kingdom, and see what they give us next year.
New trouble started when King Ahab tried to buy land from Naboth. His Phoenician wife forged Ahab's name to papers directing that Naboth's land be confiscated on the charge that he had blasphemed the names of Elohim and the king. He and his sons were promptly executed. The vigorous Elijah appeared on the scene, denouncing Ahab for the murder of the Naboths. Thus, Elijah, one of the greatest of the prophets, began his teaching as a defender of the old land mores, as against the land-selling attitude of the Baalim, against the attempt of the cities to dominate the country. But the reform did not succeed until the country landlord Jehu joined forces with the gypsy chieftain Jehonadab to destroy the prophets, real estate agents, of Baal at Samaria.
Yeah, so, I mean, there, you know, in Jesus' time, you had that whole area called Samaria, but there's an actual, you know, city named Samaria, again, a little bit further, yet further north from Shiloh. Yeah, so you've got the real estate agents, you know, the so-called prophets of Baal. And see, notice what, you know, what's happening here. So yeah, another big figure is Jehu, who, you know, just lays waste to the whole house of Omri. He just, you know, kills every one of them he can get his hands on. All right, it's a total bloody coup. And look at all the complexities going on. You know, when you've got Jezebel, you know, the Phoenician wife there, when you've got Jezebel with her scheming there, supposedly the Naboth had blasphemed the names not of Yahweh and the king, see, but of Elohim and the king. I see, so look how far it's gone from the temple of Yahweh. It's Shiloh. Right? We're now actually blaspheming Elohim, not Yahweh. You know, Elijah comes in, like we read about, you know, briefly before, and you know, there's always more killing to be done.
And then
you can kill someone for killing the owner of the land, and you know, it's just, you know, killing begets killing, and you know. It was a very vigorous time for any changes to occur. There was no peaceful transitions of power or anything like that, whether you were a prophet or a king. Okay. As we read about before. But you can see, you know, so this coup that Jehu mounts, he's bringing back in some of that Yahweh influence in contrast to Elohim, because who does he join forces with? See, one of those nomads, the quote-unquote gypsy chieftain right there. Okay. So, you know, without them, without, you know, having them, you know, needing for them need to say it, you know what's between the lines there when you're talking about those more Bedouin land mores there. And so, all right, you set up just an endless back and forth, and as we'll see, it's a lot of times it's not at all like gets portrayed in the Old Testament. There's a lot more acceptance of the Baal cult, you know, at times than you would imagine from the story in the Old Testament. Right? It's not as white hat, black hat as the Old Testament story makes it seem. The hats switch back and forth, you know. Baal has the white hat, and Yahweh has the black hat, and then it switches the other way, and it goes back and forth and back and forth, okay? all right, so that's what's going on. You've got that dynasty set up, and it's all overthrown. You kind of set up a new dynasty with Jehu. Yeah, so that's that's the basics of what happened, and that's what they're reminding you of by pointing out those two elements. Right?
New life appeared as Jehoash and his son Jeroboam delivered Israel from its enemies. But by this time, there ruled in Samaria a gangster nobility whose depredations rivaled those of the Davidic dynasty of olden days. State and church went along hand in hand. The attempt to suppress freedom of speech led Elijah, Amos, and Hosea to begin their secret writing. And this was the real beginning of the Jewish and Christian Bibles.
Okay, so you got the kind of new dynasty going they're talking about there. But it's getting very corrupt again, just like the Davidic one did. Pillaging on steroids, hence words like depredations and gangster nobility. So, such corrupt affairs, it's going to eat itself from the inside out, obviously. You know, they're not going to be able to stand long, even if they've kind of gotten their feet under them for a little while. You know, they're going to be their own worst enemy in short order and can, be conquered because of it.
It seems to me that with the destruction of the Baalites or the private ownership of land, now it's like whoever's got the longest knife.
The more you inescapably have kind of a settled people, they aren't literally nomads out in the desert, you're going to have to bring in some modifications to the Yahweh scheme, right? It's just, you can't hold on to it in pure form for very long. You know? So that writing is kind of on the wall here. One of the ways that you're going to get out of that tension is that you're going to discover that actually Yahweh is okay with the private ownership of land, right? And then that whole tension will go away. And remember how we've mentioned a number of times, like they said, their state and church went along hand in hand, and how that's an important part of the process. You can't totally separate church and state early on, when you're still in the monarchical phase. You kind of need that to support the monarchy. But eventually, when you get past monarchies, then you can start aggressively separating church and state. And then that final statement. So the way this works with Hebrew as a language, it starts to have some integrity as a written language around 1000 BC. Okay. You're not using the current squarish-like characters that everyone is familiar with Hebrew yet. You're using an older set of characters that are a little bit more tied to the Phoenician alphabet. As you're moving towards the exile of the southern kingdom, in 6th century BC, like you've heard me say many times, it's sort of, that's when you kind of bring all the elements together to kind of get Hebrew to where you think of it as today, both as a spoken and as a written language. But for a long time you have a spoken language without a written one. We have archaeological evidence of a written language around 1000 BC. And then as we move in, remember we started the story kind of in the 10th century there with Solomon, you know, towards the end of the 10th century with Solomon, and immediately after that, you know, you're moving into the 9th century BC, you know, and then into the 8th century BC here, these guys. So as you're approaching the 6th century BC, you begin to have, as they're pointing out, a little bit more definitive religious writing going on, and the beginnings of what the priests are going to be utilizing to base the complete rewriting of everything come the exile. Yeah. So it didn't all, you know, either. Not only the sort of the written story that the Hebrews are keeping of themselves, it didn't all kind of just happen right around the 6th century BC. It was getting going earlier than that. And the language was starting to move into that, you know, that kind of full biblical Hebrew sort of form too, at the same time. So it's all kind of coalescing so that coincidentally they sort of have the sense of themselves and the complexity of a spoken language and a greater sophistication of a written language kind of all together to make the Old Testament kind of come to be in the wake of the 6th century BC. An important part of making Hebrew what it is today is bringing in the Aramaic Semitic tongue that they're picking up when they're in the exile, you know, kind of blending that into Hebrew. Okay, so it's this whole complex phenomenon culturally and then this kind of this basic religious sense of themselves, evolution. And it's all happening simultaneously, kind of coming together to make this, to make the Old Testament as we know it, you know, come to pass.
Yeah. So, language had to be an integral part of that, didn't it? It's like, yeah. Greek and Latin have kind of the language and the thoughts, thinking that was going on in those periods reflect one another.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrews were religious people rather than philosophic people.
Yeah. But it's not surprising that if you're getting more reflection that's producing some religious progress, like we went through the prophets and we see it culminating with 2nd Isaiah, for instance, you know, the conception of God was definitely elevating, you know, in a growingly reflective people. I mean, language is going to progress too in a growingly reflective people. I see. So all these evolutionary processes are happening in parallel because of the greater reflective lives of the people. You know, and then really having that stimulus of being immersed into that culture in Mesopotamia that's still, you know, has shadows cast from the Andites. I mean, that was sort of the final piece to bring the sophistication of reflection all together to produce the Old Testament. And as we'll see as we finish out this section, produce one of the more significant events in the evolution of religion in human history. You know, it took foreign captivity to do it. Right? It took that kind of an external stimulus to spark an improved inner life consciousness. Yeah. It's very much like the four indispensables that we always talk about with, you know, to progress civilization. Those initial ones are very external cattle prod things, but they produce an inner reflective improvement. Yeah. Yeah. Until finally you can You don't have to be poked in the ribs, right? You can initiate it of your own free will inside an inner life improvement. But that isn't the way it starts. It starts with an external forcing. All right. See how that, like they're mentioning there, and this was the real beginning of the Jewish and Christian Bibles. So, like I said, it's beginning this greater reflective nature, relationship to eternity nature. Okay? All right.
But the northern kingdom did not vanish from history until the king of Israel conspired with the king of Egypt and refused to pay further tribute to Assyria. Then began the 3-year siege, followed by the total dispersion of the northern kingdom. Ephraim, Israel, thus vanished. Judah, the Jews, the quote, remnant of Israel, had begun the concentration of land in the hands of the few, as Isaiah said, quote, adding house to house and field to field, unquote. Presently, there was in Jerusalem a temple of Baal alongside the temple of Yahweh. This reign of terror was ended by a monotheistic revolt led by the boy king, Joash, who crusaded for Yahweh for 35 years.
Okay, so number of things there. So you're finally going to, towards the end of the 8th century B.C., the northern kingdom is finally overthrown, and you have this total dispersion. So you no longer have Ephraim or Israel, in any literal way. And then, like we've mentioned, see, now very much so, you're bringing the Jews into existence in contrast to the Hebrews. Right? When it boils down to being basically Judah, then it really is not so much this greater Hebraic concept, but it's the Jews. It's those of Judah, right? It's the Jews. And you have those lines from the Bible, quote unquote, the remnant of Israel. But look at, like I said, see, they're bringing in, they've got to bring in some of this land ownership concept. But it's going to be a very difficult thing to do. You don't just totally absorb land ownership into the Yahweh cult. Initially, you'll do things like have two temples side by side. Right? I mean, that's certainly not something you think of as the heyday of Jerusalem, having a temple to Baal right next to the temple to Yahweh. Right? But you see, it actually was. There was a temple of Baal alongside the temple of Yahweh. But obviously, there's a lot of people, especially in the southern parts of the southern kingdom, right, where it's quite desert, that are going to be holding on more tightly to the old Yahweh land mores. And so, you're going to have a revolt against bringing Baal mores into play. But on the positive side, they're pointing out, don't forget, we're trying to get to monotheism, and even though the Baal cult is bringing in the land ownership that you eventually need for civilization, it's Baal is not a singular god, right? He's a local god. There's a Baal for this plot of land and a Baal for this plot of land, etc. So there's a positive and a negative to the cult, right? It's helping to move civilization forward, but it's dragging religious evolution back.
Kind of like Buddhas.
Yeah. All right. So you've got this very complex tension that they've got to work through. And obviously the only way they're going to be able to get out of this is to be ripped from that land. and stuck in a foreign place, and then they can sort it out, right? But it's very difficult for anyone with any sanghic mentality to see themselves as independent of the land, you know, and hence to actually really become genuinely religious, to have a genuine inner life, right? Your sanghic mentality, no matter what your skin color is, binds you to the land, and you tend to put the land before yourself, right? Right, you know, God gave this land to me, for instance, right? But eventually, people have to put themselves transcend into the land, right? You define the land rather than the land defining you.
What do you make of this comment about when this had begun the concentration of land in the hands of the few?
Right. I mean, you just... See, you know, she's just, you know, the notice they're, you know, telling you, even in Isaiah, you've got that adding house to house and field to field. You have to have fields first before you can add field to field. So obviously, you know, the more you bring in the land ownership mores, then you're going to have the excesses of that where someone tries to, you know, own all the land unto themselves and be lord over it all. I mean, you know, that's one way to take the many bales and turn them into one bale is to turn all the landowners into one landowner and his one bale, right? So you can see there's evolutionary processes that are kind of driving this.
Well, that certainly doesn't strike me as being progressive.
Right, but it's just, you know, you have to put yourself back in those times when, you know, they didn't know anything else, right? You know, and it's a convenient thing for the way humans tend to naturally think. You know, we love to break everything into dichotomies, right? And so you make the Yahweh Baal dichotomy, right? And it's a simplistic way to interpret, you know, everything in the world in a dichotomy. But nonetheless, despite what the people are thinking and all of their tensions and warring to call it a crusade, it's kind of a funny thing. Joash's crusade for Yahweh. Talk about foreshadowing Jesus. It's just always notice between the lines. Humans progress in spite of themselves. I mean, there's the evolutionary process is always working with it. And like I said, if you didn't get monotheism with Yahweh, you could do it with the Baal thing, like I just said. You could get all the Baals to coalesce into one Baal by getting all the landowners to coalesce into one landowner. That would be a way that the evolutionary process could get the end result it's seeking. It'll always do it, just like when we were reading the biologic evolution, and no matter how many vicissitudes there were, the evolutionary process always finds some way. Right? There may be many failed efforts at mammals, but eventually there's going to be mammals. It's going to find a way. The evolutionary process will find a way to mammals. It'll find a way to monotheism, no matter what foolish notions the humans have in their head. One way or another, it'll come to pass. Now, some paths involve a lot more pain and suffering for humans and others, but the evolutionary process doesn't care how much pain and suffering there is. It's just trying to achieve an end by any means, and it will achieve it. If it has to steamroll lots of humans in the process, it will. Okay. How many species had to, you know, to live and die to produce humans? Countless millions of species, right, had to sacrifice themselves for your sake to exist biologically. And it's not like us where we treat every species as sacred that we want to save for all eternity. That, the evolutionary process doesn't falsely existentialize things like that. It's got an end point that it's going towards, and it'll get there one way or another. That's when it's, you really need to separate inner life from outer life, because the God of love, see, it's going to be more and more difficult to find him out there, when you're underneath that steamroller of evolution I was just talking about. No matter how much it flattens things out there, nothing squishes your inner life. It has an absolute framing that can't be crushed, except by you, right? Your own free will. So, the more you appreciate that it's an evolutionary world, the more you need God inside and not, this ghost cult God that the Hebrews are struggling with. They think he's out here. And they're getting all disillusioned because they can't seem to find this glorious God that they imagine out there underneath the steamroller. Whether that steamroller is called Assyria or Babylon or Egypt or whatever. Or the Romans. It's an important lesson to get this separate. And the more you can separate an inner life from an outer life, well, then you're going to have a civilization where you can separate church and state too. But not until. All right. So you got the. See, we've shifted down to the. To the Southern Kingdom now, and we're going through those final times, leading into those final times of the 7th century BC, right before they get sent into exile.
The next king, Amaziah, had trouble with the revolting, tax-paying Edomites and their neighbors. After a signal victory, he turned to attack his northern neighbors and was just as signally defeated. Then the rural folk revolted. They assassinated the king and put his 16-year-old son on the throne. This was Azariah, called Uzziah by Isaiah. After Uzziah, things went from bad to worse, and Judah existed for 100 years by paying tribute to the kings of Assyria. Isaiah the first told them that Jerusalem, being the city of Yahweh, would never fall. But Jeremiah did not hesitate to proclaim its downfall.
See how we're sweeping through the 7th century BC there, coming up on the destruction of Jerusalem.
That's a description of that separation right there you were just talking about. The difference between Isaiah the first and Jeremiah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and who is the person that so definitively speaks of a genuine inner life, speaks of the heart? Right? Jeremiah. Right? When he finally can separate them, he knows, no, the real Yahweh is about my inner life. He's not going to stop Jerusalem from being destroyed. That's not what he's about. He's not a material technique. He's not our material father. Jeremiah can do what Isaiah, couldn't. He can see it clearly. He isn't projecting a confused inner life out onto the external world and muddling it all up, which, of course, is what we're reading about, taking the secular history out there and projecting it, onto it and turning it into an imaginary sacred history. Right? Again, that's caused by the inability to have an inner life that stands unmoved relative to the outer life.
And to your point, even today, so many people, that's their whole religion. That's their, mm-hmm. That is their inner life, so to speak.
Yes.
The whole They've turned it into that.
Yeah, they turned themselves inside out.
And you can't, no matter what you do, it's really hard to get them to see it another way.
Yeah.
It might not happen in this. But this is interesting. It seems to me, maybe just because you look at this, it's just one battle after another, one guy taking over here, one guy taking over there. I mean, no diplomacy, doesn't look like it anyway.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, just chaos.
And it's so important to remember that, you know, you can take things forward, 3,000, 2,000 years, nothing's really changed in the mindsets of those people in the Near East. This is still, right, their mentality, right? You can't treat them as a people that have really definitive inner life separated from outer lives, and you can appeal to, you know, to their, you know, their sense of what is true and right in their inner life. You know, they aren't people like that.
Some of them.
Yeah, only a few, right? And they're probably not going to be the ones that are the political leaders, you know, that you're going to have to deal with. So it's, you know, there are people that really, you know, remember how we were reading before, people would actually submit to a change in the political affairs simply because they definitively believed that their God was this external world fact, and if the external world got overthrown, right, they would freely admit, oh, your God is stronger than my God. Okay, so, you know, I put myself under your rulership. You know, see how it's, to get from tribe to nation, it's actually kind of important that people have all this false stuff out in the external world so that they will actually let go, accept defeat. I mean, if no one ever accepts defeat, how are you going to get from tribe to nation? Right? And if you cease accepting defeat, you're going to go back to tribe from nation. Right? Yeah, we see that more and more and more. Right? And so, see, the evolutionary process is sneaky. Right? The fact that you're immature and you're projecting all of what you think of as an inner life into the external world, it actually helps. You'll let go. Because you can't deny, right, that, you know, your army just got wiped out. Yeah. You know, and you believe that your God is, you know, puppeting that army. So, right, it's proof. You know, so you quote unquote let go of your inner life pride, right? You know, your God, because he obviously just got defeated. So he's a lesser God. You know? And you're a lesser people, so right, the greater people have a right to rule over you. You'll accept that. And it's part of that process. Those people appreciate external shows of force, right? Because they put more substance in that than a people that has more of an inner life do, right? The more you have a really definitive inner life, you don't, you know, put all your eggs in that basket out there, right? I mean, you know, it's like, oh yeah, well, you know, things, you know, kingdoms come and go and whatnot, right? But my inner life is the real me. That's where the real strength is to be found, the real substance is to be found. See, when a more primitive people, right, they, for good and for ill, put everything out there, right? And if they think that they're in control out there, they think that their God is greater than your God, and you know, and they have a right then to keep going. The only way to get them to submit is to defeat their God of their outer life. Yep.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, Jesus with the apostles. You know, they kept wanting to make him Messiah. They just had that same mindset you're just talking about.
Yeah.
And even though they lived with God for 4 or 5 years, it still didn't, you know, got somewhere, I'm sure, but he kept on. Finally, he said, okay, you know, if you got to call me Messiah, call me Messiah. But
right.
It was a similar kind of what you're talking about. It didn't change a whole lot.
right.
in that period of time.
Yeah, see, again, that's what Jesus was struggling with. I mean, the same thing we're struggling with today. People that just put all of, like I said, all their eggs in that outer life basket. I mean, it's just, you can't somehow snap your fingers and change that. That's just the way they view themselves. Like I was saying, you know, a bit ago, that's a big step forward, you know, to in terms of biologic uplift, when you see yourself as transcendent of the land, right? Independent of even of the land, courageous and independent cosmic thinking. But more primitive people, they don't, you know, they see themselves as totally bound to the land. You know, the land, you know, the land is over them. You know, they're not over the land. And so it, you know, you have to flip that 180 degrees and see, and all these things are connected. You know, and when you can flip that, you're separating an inner life from an outer life. All right, see, what else do we have here? You notice that we've got all kinds of boy kings and 16-year-old sons. And okay, you know, what does that mean? You've got a bunch of older guys in the court that are really running things. That's going to increase the amount of corruption and machinations. And, yeah, so you can see how this is all. They're just eating themselves from the inside out here again. You know, with that internal corruption. Let's see. Anything else there? Oh, you were talking about wars and stuff. We didn't comment. We missed kind of a little funny that the author threw in there. Way back when we were reading about Shalmaneser and King Ahab and stuff, did you notice that bit about King Ahab of Ephraim gathered 10 other groups?
Yeah.
And then the author couldn't resist Melchizedek. You know, he said that, but the allies were decimated. he couldn't resist the fact that it was 10 other groups, you know, to use decimated. They were broken back up into their tents. Yes. Yeah, sorry, I missed it back there. I had to go back because it's just it's a funny when you notice that. Why did he select decimated there?
Decimated.
You know, deci, you know, means tenth, right? You know, so if you take the 10 that are working as one and you split them back into their 10 tenths, right? Yeah, they're decimated. Yes. Yeah, it's a funny. But you got that, like John was saying, you know, over and over and over again, even when you're not making a pun out of it like that. I mean, that is just, you know, once you didn't have that incredibly powerful king like Solomon, even though a king like that produces all kinds of excesses, right, but it can hold everything together, right? And he can be on the top, not some steward, you know, over the three-year-old or something, right? Right, he can be on top, he can see to it if there's corruption, it's his corruption, at least it's centralized corruption, you know, and it's not, you know, that distributed, just completely self-destructive corruption where it's in every nook and cranny everywhere. Yeah, so, but all of that, it just, once you leave Solomon behind, it's just a matter of time, you know, and it took a little bit longer in the southern kingdom than the northern kingdom for them to just, you know, completely lose all of that nation integrity that was holding them together and just become a ragtag bunch of people that can be conquered easily again.
Let's see if we can squeeze comment in here. Pain and Suffering Institutes, Evolutionary Changes, and Biological Adaptations. Mutation.
Yeah, I mean, that whole pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. You know, so much of biologic evolution, right, is that survival of the fittest thing, right? I mean, you have this very aggressive external stimulus that's that's driving the adaptive system. Right? And that's just, you know, before you start to take a hold of yourself, you know, the way you are altered is by an external stimulus that mind adapts to, right? So your mind has progressed in spite of yourself.
The greatest affliction is never to be afflicted.
And the greatest affliction is never to be afflicted. All those sorts of things, right? But you know, the whole point eventually to get to light in life, you have to leave all of that starting outside, you know, behind. And it needs to start more and more inside. You know, and Jesus was trying to get that going with seek first the kingdom of heaven, right? Get an inside started, you know, and then we can start to turn everything else around. You'll like your life much better if evolution doesn't have to use a cattle prod on you all the time, right? I mean, it's going to continue to use a cattle prod until you turn it around, right? Right. So, yes, it takes a long time for that to sink into a people. Yeah.
I was thinking again about excesses. I never thought about excesses being part of the evolutionary process. But there seems to be.
Oh, yeah.
It's very much a part. Mm-hmm. It reminded me back when eyes first were developed in prehistoric animal life. Suddenly there were these animals with eyes everywhere.
Eyes everywhere, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
it's a spiritual consciousness that bridles against that and wants to bring order, some kind of order back into it.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you on the webinar, he's bringing up a great point there. That I mean, excesses are an essential part of the evolutionary process. I mean, you know, if you think back, we've pointed it out many, many times. Not just biologic excesses in the biologic evolutionary process, but all kinds of things. And we were looking at the evolution of civilization. Over and over again, we saw how evolution would utilize the excesses as a contrast. I mean, more as our own internal consciousness contrast recognition. That's how you get from the material comfort era, right, to the quest for knowledge and wisdom, remember. The reason that there's tyranny, gluttony, drunkenness, you know, all those excesses, etc., of the material comfort era, they're essential in the evolutionary process for you to recognize the better way. The only way for the quest for knowledge and wisdom to dawn, you know, a very definitive inner life predicate to dawn in civilization, is for the outer life, you know, to become completely unfulfilling, you know, by just quantitative effort, right? I mean, that's the outer life. The only way it can make things fancier is more and more quantity. The inner life has another option, quality, right? The quest for quality of thinking, right? Being that in contrast to merely quantitative thinking, and that contrast is recognized because of the excesses of quantity, right? And it's just the only way for that to dawn in your mind is to leverage off the excesses.
It burns out, and then it's impotent, and then now what?
Right. And so whether it's a conscious thing or not, it's essential to the evolutionary process to use those excesses as a means you know, to continue to progress the system. Yeah, so you can spend a lot of time thinking about that, just how an interesting phenomenon that is, yes. Yeah, whether you're thinking about political evolution or anything, you know, just to not be so hard on the excesses that you might see, right? There's, you know, when the excesses get extreme, you're quivering on the very brink of something wonderful, right? Because excesses can only go so far, you know, and then you leverage off of those and go forward. Okay, let's see, where were we? So we had Jeremiah, let's see. That's where we were.
Yeah, on that line that runs up to Bezos.
What was that?
The line that eventuated in Bezos, the Amazonian. Amaziah, right.
Yes, we had all those IAHs there. We had Azariah called Uzziah by Isaiah. If you can keep that all straight in your head. All right, let's keep going.
The real undoing of Judah was affected by a corrupt and rich ring of politicians operating under the rule of a boy king, Manasseh. The changing economy favored the return of the worship of Baal, whose private land dealings were against the ideology of Yahweh. The fall of Assyria and the ascendancy of Egypt brought deliverance to Judah for a time, and the country folk took over. Under Josiah, they destroyed the Jerusalem ring of corrupt politicians.
Okay, see, so you get this ebb and flow. But you can just see what we were just talking about right there. I mean, you know, things push forward just because the political sphere gets so hopelessly corrupt that, you know, the only thing you can do is react, react in opposition to it. Right? You know, even those who want to benefit from it becomes so corrupt that you can't even go, you know, appear to go forward with it. And the only way, you know, is to go in contrast to it. But again, you see how we got another boy king. You know, we got, you know, and so you just have all of these machinations of the court and whatnot. All these people, you know, trying to vie for power and all that. You know, that whole issue of how important it was to the evolution of civilization to have a strong, you know, singular leader.
I'm a little confused about what actually happened. The country folk were, what were their interests? Josiah was just their leader.
Right. So I mean. Yeah, so you know, you every time the country folk take over, you're going to get Yahweh being pushed back above Baal again.
Okay.
Right. So again, it's the contrast. You know, if you've got Baal in ascendancy, as it were, but everything gets all corrupt under him. Right, the contrast is to go to Yahweh, because Baal is corrupt, you know. And then when Yahweh gets all corrupt, then you go to Baal to overcome the Yahweh corruption, you know. And see, it just goes back and forth and back and forth.
The big city and the flyover.
You know, when I was a kid, we would often divide up on the playground between town kids and the country kids.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was,
yep,
that was just a natural,
yeah,
there was a natural
polarized
conversation.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Remember how we talked about all that stuff, the land man ratio, all those sorts of things, you know. It's an innate part of our natural consciousness, like you're saying, it's very natural for the kids on the playground, you know, if it's in an area where you have rural kids and city kids, you know, to break up, playing some game, it's the city kids against the country kids or whatever. Yeah. All right.
But this era came to a tragic end when Josiah presumed to go out to intercept Necho's mighty army as it moved up the coast from Egypt for the aid of Assyria against Babylon. He was wiped out, and Judah went under tribute to Egypt. The Baal political party returned to power in Jerusalem, and thus began the real Egyptian bondage. Then ensued a period in which the Baalim politicians controlled both the courts and the priesthood. Baal worship was an economic and social system dealing with property rights as well as having to do with soil fertility.
Okay, so, when we've been talking about all of these political vicissitudes here, see, where was that when they mentioned earlier, when they went out to do the to conquer the Edomites, and then where was that? Who was it that was doing that? I can't remember now where that was. Can anyone find that? Where in the heck was that when they were mentioning that? But it was another example where every time they try to go beyond the immediacy of where they are, in that case, if I could find it, where they mentioned that. Remember, you've got those peoples that are immediately to the east of, you know, not just east of the Jordan River proper, but, you know, there's the area, you know, that's kind of part of all these doings. It's on the east side of the Jordan. But when you go beyond that, kind of more out into the desert, right, you've got those peoples out there, you know, and that, if I could find that, that was an example where, you know, the king was going to try to, to bring them back. Oh, there it was. I see it. The next king, Amaziah, had trouble with the revolting tax-paying Edomites and their neighbors. Right? Okay, so he's going to kind of try to extend his power out there a little bit. And he has a victory there immediately, but see, when he goes to the northern neighbors, okay, he's defeated. I mean, they still have visions of sort of, you know, a David or a Solomon, sort of an influence that can spread, you know, as far as you can imagine. But if they try to do that, they're so limited and internally corrupt and whatnot, it only goes so far, if it goes at all.
They still have delusions of grandeur.
Delusions of grandeur, exactly. Right. Okay, so it's one thing to have those kind of delusions of grandeur where you're going to try to bring those tribes, to the east under your umbrella. But, I mean, look at this. but this era came to a tragic end when Josiah presumed, talk about presumption, to go out to intercept Necho's, okay, you know, the king, the Pharaoh of Egypt, right? Necho's mighty army as it moved up the coast from Egypt for the aid of Assyria against Babylon. Okay, so one thing, you know, you can see how we're beginning the process of eventually the Babylonians overthrowing the Assyrians and taking this ascendancy, you know, there in Mesopotamia and in the region.
The Egyptians were helping the Babylonians?
No, the Egyptians were going to try to help the Assyrians
to fight off
the Babylonians. Okay, but meanwhile, on the way to help the Assyrians, Necho's going up with his mighty army. And look at the delusions of grandeur. Oh, yeah, let's take on Necho's army. Like, what? They had Yahweh on their side, yeah. After all, they just totally, overthrown the Baalites again as proof that Yahweh was the greatest of all. So they ought to be able to overthrow the Egyptians, too. Oh, my word.
Going out on a high note.
Yeah, that, talk about being clueless. He was wiped out. But see, so he's wiped out. That puts Yahweh down again. And so what happens? The Baal political party returned to power in Jerusalem.
The real Egyptian bondage.
Oh yeah, I'm going to get to that. Yeah, just a second. But just that bit of, you know, and you could think about, not only is it Baal's put down, you got to go to the other side of the dichotomy. Okay, there's that simple. But coincidentally, you know, which is going to sync up better with kind of being ruled by the Egyptians, Baal or Yahweh? Well, Baal, right? Because he had more of that private land ownership, a little bit more of a progressed civilization mentality. Yeah, and then the line that John was just saying, and thus began the real Egyptian bondage. And notice they italicized real. Okay, so what are they referring to? Remember back when they started this whole heretical retelling of the Old Testament, they were talking about how you know, you don't have this incredible integrous Hebrew people that are, you know, are enslaved in Egypt, you know, and then Moses frees them. You know, actually, there was a few ragtag people there, and most of the Hebrews kind of were collected as Moses and crew went out, you know, outside of Egypt, right? Right. Okay, but here, you know, you actually have this residual. Like I was saying, you know, you really have the Jews. You know, and they are in Egyptian bondage now. So the integrist group has been put in Egyptian bondage. Unlike the Old Testament makes it appear that the first time there was an integrist Jewish group that were in bondage, right, that really wasn't the case. But the interesting thing is that they say real and they italicize it, just to make the point. Right? And, you know, and we're always bringing this up. When you see the word real in the book, don't think flippantly like everyone around you speaks and uses the word real. The relatives aren't being flippant with the word real. They mean real. They mean something that really was more impacting the relationship to eternity, right, and the inner life. Okay. So, see, this is one of the very last things before they're taken into exile. You know, they have all this attempt to be connected to eternity with so much outer life crutch to that connection to eternity. And that needs, they need to be completely disabused of that. That needs to be crushed. If they're going to find the real inner life, all false inner life, you know, mentality has to be crushed. You know, either you choose to crush it yourself and begin anew with a genuine inner life, or the evolutionary process will crush it for you. One way or another, right, it's all set up. Right? You have to let go of that. Yeah, so they're feeling real bondage now. I mean, this is just sort of the final straw of Yahweh and you know, their relationship to Yahweh and connection to eternity just being crushed. You know, their supposed connection to eternity. Okay, so they're being set up. And they're going to be ripped away from the land now. You know, that God gave to them, quote unquote. Right, and maybe they can actually find the inner life for the first time in their history now. Right, but it's taken endless school of hard knocks, pounding on them and pounding on them. Yeah, I mean, even if they could just see the very fact that they would stop ignoring, you know, what's in front of their eyes, that it's bouncing back and forth between Yahweh and Baal, these two. Two options of the outer life. Does that sound like something that has to do with a changeless God? You know, I mean, it's just kind of right there, but they're not getting it, and they're not getting it. So the evolutionary process is just going to push harder and harder and harder until you get it. You know, there's no escaping it. I mean, all of us have to face this. If you refuse to predicate your life on a genuine inner life and insist upon picking some false thing in the outer life to exalt, I mean, the evolutionary process is a vast conspiracy. It's going to break that. Right? And it'll hit you harder and harder until you let go. This is the way the real world works.
It ends up being a dead-end street.
Yeah. So one way or another, you've got to let go. Right? And when you're talking about religion, you know, the key thing we're talking about here is you've got to let go of your false god. no matter how earnest you are and humble you are and whatnot, with this ghost cult God that you're holding on to, it's, you know, eventually you've got to let go of that. And you can do it of your own free will, or you can take the pain and suffering process of evolution. Right? It's the only technique evolution knows, is to give you more and more pain and suffering until you can't hold on and you let go.
Well, that's one of the beauties of your Ranchi book. It really gives you a real perspective about God that you never had before. You know, because most people in the world still, their picture of God, what they've been taught, they don't have a big picture of the truth of the God living within you, as well as the whole way the whole universe is designed and put together. And you know what I'm saying? It's a loving atmosphere. Most people don't have that at all. We're lucky we have that. So it's hard for them to be able, as you say, to be able to focus on that inside when they don't have any idea what it is, which I think is one of the main reasons here for this book, is to be able to help bring people along and teach them, as well as all the other stuff we're reading. But yeah, that's got to be somewhat critical. I know it was for me when I found out who God really was. It was like, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. You know. Well, that's totally different. If God's like that,
yeah, right. And he's a loving God, and he's like, and it's all, and oh, by the way, he's pretty well together. He's pretty organized. And it's amazing. And I think that's what's one of the beauties of a revelation, to be honest with you, to be able to do that. Because it's hard. I mean, I grew up in a Christian religion. Which is, and very serious about it, etc. But I never had a concept, from the Christian religion one way or another. And I knew God loved me, but I had no concept of really who God was. I had no concept who Jesus was. Where'd he come from? Who was he? He lived here, but as being a God.
Well, you'll see, the section is titled, this great big long section is titled Hebrew History. But you'll see when all is said and done, as we begin to wrap up this section, there's something here that goes way beyond clarifying the fictitious Hebrew history in the Old Testament. There's something here for you, right? The real thread of truth that's flowing through this is what I was just emphasizing, right? I mean, they're telling you the real story of the Hebrews so that you can understand what your life is going to be like if you refuse to take control with a life that's predicated on an inner domain. If you insist upon living a life that's ruled from the outside in, it's not a life that you want. Okay? You don't want to have to be pounded for 1,000 years like the Hebrews were before you finally let go and find genuine religion. And not to jump ahead, but you'll see the bottom line that they're coming up to here shortly. Okay, let's see. So you got Josiah's. Oh yeah, I'm going to take on Necho's army. In ensued a period in which the Balaam politicians controlled both the courts and the priesthood. Oh, I'll bet you there's not going to be any corruption, and that's set up.
Well, they have to pay tribute.
Yeah, and they have to pay tribute. Yes, and all that.
Real estate agents ruled.
Okay, so what happens next?
With the overthrow of Necho by Nebuchadnezzar, Judah fell under the rule of Babylon and was given 10 years of grace, but soon rebelled. When Nebuchadnezzar came against them, the Judahites started social reforms, such as releasing slaves, to influence Yahweh. When the Babylonian army temporarily withdrew, the Hebrews rejoiced that their magic of reform had delivered them. It was during this period that Jeremiah told them of the impending doom and presently Nebuchadnezzar returned.
Ah, good old prophet of doom, Jeremiah.
So is this saying that the Egyptians and the Assyrians, even though they joined forces, didn't work out, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, you know, took control, and eventually, you know, it not only did he take over this Assyria, but, you know, he overthrew Necho. And look at what happens. You know, remember the preceding paragraph, they were all in with Baal again. Mm-hmm. Okay, but things are going poorly. So, well, the obvious thing is to go with Yahweh again. It's like, you know, you just go back and forth and back and forth. So they dream up, you know, what it is that will be pleasing to the nostrils of Yahweh.
At least they're not sacrificing their kids.
Yeah, right. Yeah, at least they're, you know, doing things like releasing slaves. See, and of course, you know, why because slaves are tied to, you know, being able to have land and to farm it, you know, that whole bit of slavery is indispensable, right? You know that. You know, right, so they're thinking that that's the problem. They've progressed too much, you know, and they need to go back to the old ways. But, you know, from our perspective, we think, well, yes, that's a great thing, you know, to release the slaves. It's like, no, remember, this is back when having slaves is a step forward, right? So they're going backward again. The way that we still convince ourselves that prayer and God and all such are material techniques, right? There's some coincidence that you know seems to confirm our assumption, right?
Happens all the time.
Yes. You know, and that's why you know that God really does care about, you know, those material things, right? You know, because that one time when it seemed that, you know, everything happened like it was supposed to, and you conveniently forget the million and one times and it didn't, right? All right, so here it is. They're doing the same thing. The Hebrews rejoiced that their magic of reform had delivered them. You know, but Jeremiah, who separated the inner and the outer, is like, no, guys. that's not what's going on here.
Pouring water on it.
No.
Not having it.
All right.
But that's when they dumped him in the mire, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We're not taking that.
Yes. He was like I said, the good old prophet of doom there, who had to face the consequences of being a prophet of doom.
He was going to listen to him. He's in the pit.
And so the end of Judah came suddenly. The city was destroyed, and the people were carried away into Babylon. The Yahweh-Baal struggle ended with the captivity, and the captivity shocked the remnant of Israel into monotheism.
Okay, so...
voltage.
Yeah, I mean, when you all of your outer life is taken away, your only option is an inner life. See? And again, is that the only way that God is going to finally reach you? When you are face down in the gutter, you know, wallowing in your own excrement, right? Is that what it's going to take for you to finally let go and start anew with an inner life? We all know that that's many people. That's the only way. They find themselves face down in the gutter, and there's only two options, then: death or turning around. Unfortunately, a lot of humans today, that's the only way, is to take the cattle prod all the way to the end where the next poke kills you. Right? You know, and you know, we all admire those individuals who don't die at that point. Actually, you know, a lot of times we say they found religion or something, right? But whatever it is, you know, they finally would let go of the outer life being first. And, you know, And usually the only way that people will let go is when there's literally nothing left to hang on to. They have to lose all their family, all their possessions, right? And they barely have even clothes on their back. There's no food in their belly. They've lost everything. There's nothing left in the external world to hold on anymore. And then and only then, maybe, not 100%, but sometimes, yeah, they'll actually take a hold of spirit substance.
Or they curse God and all their problems.
Right.
So you're right.
It's amazing. Right. It's just the revelation is trying to remind us there's another option. Right? You can take the light in cultivating instead of having to be pounded with a sledgehammer. You know.
So when it says the remnant of Israel, that's for the people who got captured, not the people who maybe got left behind, right? And the captivity shocked the remnant of Israel into monotheism.
You're right. I mean, they're just, you know, that's the Israel in the greater sense, not the Northern Kingdom sense. You know, that's in, yeah. If it all is said and done, we've got a few people that haven't been dispersed to the four winds already. Right, that remnant that's taken into captivity in Babylon.
I gotcha.
Right. you know, which, like we've said, is really kind of now not the Hebrews so much as the Jews. Right. Okay, and like I said before, obviously this is, you know, finally the whole dichotomy in the back and forth, pendulum swinging back and forth between Yahweh and Baal, okay, that's done.
Do you think the land was depopulated, or was it just the core, the city dwellers who were...
I mean, the conquerors, you know, took possession of the land.
So the land, people within and without the city.
Yeah, I mean, just all the Jews were taken out, and others moved in, took over. You know, it's like what happened, you know, in AD 70. Right? And it took a long time before there were Jews in Palestine again. Others lived there, right? I mean, you took the Jews out of Palestine, and it's not like there was no one there for centuries. Others were there. Okay, but what you finally ended up with getting the monotheism, in many ways, is not because finally you rejected Baal and went with Yahweh. You know, like I said, you rejected the outer life and kind of the false monotheism of the outer life Yahweh, and found the genuine inner life where there is only, you know, monotheism. The genuine inner life is innately monotheistic. Right? There's not many first sources and centers of all things and all beings. There's one, right? It's inescapable that when you finally go to the inner life, you start with, you know, true monotheism. And so that's what's happening. You know, you've torn the entire external world away from them, and all that's left is the faint little flicker of an inner life that's put in there by grace in every one of us at roughly age 6. You seek first the kingdom of heaven as a little child, like Jesus told you to do. Okay.
In Babylon, the Jews arrived at the conclusion that they could not exist as a small group in Palestine, having their own peculiar social and economic customs, and that if their ideologies were to prevail, they must convert the Gentiles. Thus originated their new concept of destiny, the idea that the Jews must become the chosen servants of Yahweh. The Jewish religion of the Old Testament really evolved in Babylon during the captivity.
Now, of course, we all know they struggle with, this whole bit of being a small group in Palestine, having their own peculiar social and economic customs. And even if they aren't in Palestine, being a small group that has their own peculiar social and economic customs.
Even here in Boulder.
Yeah, no matter where they are, New York City or Boulder or wherever they are, right? Right. So this is, you can just see the tensions are still there today. Right? And the problem for current Jews is can you let go of that really old mentality that wants to be a small group having their own peculiar social and economic customs and yet still have religion? Those that let go of that end up kind of losing religion, right? And are just cultural Jews. So it's a tricky thing for them to this day still. All right, and here's the really key statement here.
The doctrine of immortality also took form at Babylon. The Jews had thought that the idea of the future life detracted from the emphasis of their gospel of social justice. Now, for the first time, theology displaced sociology and economics. Religion was taking shape as a system of human thought and conduct, more and more to be separated from politics, sociology, and economics.
Okay. That's the paragraph I refer to all the time. It was in Babylon that they finally discovered a genuine inner life of some sort, genuine religion, apart from social justice. Right? Religion, inner life. Social justice, outer life. Right? Politics, sociology, economics, outer life. Okay? Not that that's not important, but it's not what you seek first. You don't seek the outer life first. Right? And finally, when they couldn't dictate their politics, their sociology, or their economics anymore, there was nothing there to hold on to anymore that they felt was theirs, like I said. And so all, a million years of human history, and finally here in the 6th century BC with the Jews in exile, you get a group of people that takes that step. Right? And begins to separate an inner life from an outer life, to kind of follow what Jeremiah was starting there. They have the potential of being able to separate church and state and all those sorts of things. And you can just watch, it's so recent and so tenuous that mankind has taken that step. It obviously would take very little to step back across that line. Right? And throughout the 20th century and now into the 21st, you see more and more people stepping back across that line, right? And the so-called churches are, if not first about social justice, are only about social justice, right? Which means it's not religion at all anymore, right? There's no inner life fact there at all that's being fostered, right? That's the state of affairs in so much of the world. It was vanishing long ago in Europe, and it's beginning to vanish more and more in the United States. Well, here, let's go to Gene first.
I go to a mainline church, and what you're saying strikes me as very true. I see it. I live it.
Right, yeah.
Okay. And I think of the evangelicals and where they're at, in some sense, it's almost the same, just a different flavor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have to, just because it's not sort of like a quote-unquote mainline church phenomenon that it's so kind of institutionally more about social justice, the more you have a little bit more of a fundamentalist mentality about religion, it's kind of inescapable that you're going to be bringing in more outer life things. It's a very difficult process. You can give lots and lots of voice to the God of the Bible, as opposed to literally thinking of yourself as a social justice warrior. But that God of the Bible is so much an outer life God. So without you recognizing it, you actually begin to turn more and more and get involved in all the outer life things too. And the only difference is you're actually still using the word God, You know, whereas those churches that don't really talk about God anymore just talk about social issues, right? I mean, see, the only difference is whether or not you give lip service to the three-letter word, God. But at least, you know, there's a potential. You may have gone back to the outer life God, okay, but at least it's God. And so there's a potential to, you know, to transfer that God back into the inner domain again. If you've actually thrown God out of the picture, okay, now you... I mean, you've got to re-coalesce a God notion in the outer life and then internalize that God again. So, I mean, you're way, way back, you know. See, in many ways, kind of pre-primitive almost. Right? When you have no, you know, spirit world, ghost, you know, world, you know, lowercase g gods or anything sort of notion at all. Right, it's all just humanism and social justice. You know, I mean, there was never, you know, people like that really.
I remember an atheist, an observation that he made one time about religious people is that they, and he envied them because it seemed like they had a centering influence.
Mm-hmm.
But he, as an atheist, he had ideals, but they always, all of his atheist friends seemed to always be going off
right.
In a direction.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and you see that in every one of these movements. You know, they immediately just, you know, they come together for a brief moment under some, you know, common thought or goal, but in short order they all just unravel and start flying off of tangents and, you know, and becoming self-destructive and whatnot. Yeah.
So if there's really a centering influence, they have to have some relationship to the first source and center. That's the only real centering influence there would be in the inner life.
And like we've talked about, that's a sneaky thing about even if consciously, you know, what you call God is all about the outer life. Right? There's a God of the inner life by grace. And so super consciously, you know, that real God is there. And there's a subtle little thing of, you know, your ghost cult God that's in the outer life, you know, you focusing on that unwittingly gives you a little bit more super conscious identification to the real God inside. You know, which a purely humanistic mode doesn't do. It doesn't have that unconscious, you know, resonance with the inner life, and it's just totally about you and the outer life.
Yeah, you know, the doctrine of immortality. You know, most of the Judaism that I've come across doesn't teach immortality.
I remember in Jesus' time, you had the Sadducees, you know, that were still in that mode. That really, there was no. You know, life after death.
Right. Even today, though.
Yeah, and still today. See, that goes on.
I say, well, you know, thank God for life after death, you know, and they say, what makes you think
there's life after death? Yeah.
So this doctrine of immortality didn't take hold for a whole long time anyway, or whatever, but maybe right here.
Again, see, like I said, it's just so tenuous. And you
just
can,
back across
and
the
you know that, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of those Jewish friends you're talking to have, you know, they're not in that sort of hyper-Orthodox mode. They're a little bit more cultural Jews. Yeah. See, so that's the thing. So, you know, they let go of that circumscribed mentality they were just talking about there, but then they sort of lose God and you know, eternity and life after death and everything at the same time. Right?
Well, they're kind of under the delusion of, you know, the more material things I get, more God
yeah,
is down upon me in favor.
Of course.
So that's the measure of it,
yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Which...
Anyway. Yes, yeah, so you can just see, I mean, like I said, this is really great stuff. There's just so much that you can reflect on here about the society you live in and then yourself. Don't you know, find the courage to, you know, reflect on your own thoughts here too, your own relationships here.
So just carrying on that for 2 seconds here.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, no matter what, is capable of experiencing inner life.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what their religion, no matter what their situation is,
yeah.
et cetera. So So it seemed to me that, you know, rather than preaching religious doctrine, so to speak, maybe it would be wiser to cultivate, you know, the concepts of the inner life of your personal relationship with God that's not necessarily connected with any one religious doctrine or another. Whether or not that's way ahead of its time, I don't know.
Well, see, and you know, even more than, you know, God in your inner life, but just the fact of the inner life itself, that there's a domain where you're actually sovereign, and even though you can't see it and feel it between your fingers, you can take a hold of spirit substance, and you can frame your mind with it. You can direct your mind with it. Unlike how frustrating it is when you try to control exactly what this cup does, and then someone, you know, butts, elbows you and does something else with it. You know, I mean, there's a place where you can control, you can take control of the situation. You know,
but you need spiritual insight in a way.
Well, right, that's what I mean. You know, that actual spiritual ability,
controls
that domain of spirit over mind. You know, to discover your real self there, and of course, when you discover your real self, you'll discover God there. But see, there's, you know, you actually have to discover your real self first, you know, your spiritual self, and then you discover God. It's not that you find God and then you find your spiritual self; it's the other way around, right? Until you're in circuit in the Holy Spirit and have a spiritual self. For instance, an adjuster has no place to come. See, I mean, you know, which comes first? Right? So, it's, you know, that's how you find, you have to find that inner domain. You have to find your spiritual nature. Everyone knows about mind over matter. They know about how they can be driven to do certain things with matter because of how they feel about the situation. Everyone knows about that, but they don't know about what's deeper than that. Above their, you know, deeper in and above their feelings, there's a domain of your spiritual self, your spiritualized mind, where you can begin to take control and establish a character that stands independent of whether or not you got your way with a particular material issue. Yeah, and finding that and the strength that gives you, knowing that no matter what happens out there, whether you win or lose out there, there's this inner domain that stands unmoved. To discover that spiritual sovereignty potential that you have, that's what can change things. All right, let's keep going here so we can see what they kind of say in summary about all this.
And so, does the truth about the Jewish people disclose that much which has been regarded as sacred history turns out to be little more than the chronicle of ordinary profane history? Judaism was the soil out of which Christianity grew, but the Jews were not a miraculous people.
See, that final paragraph, that's why I reread that little preface paragraph at the end of section 8. You can see that when all is said and done, they come back to that same little statement. All right, so, but...
This paper's not going to go over too well over there in Tel Aviv.
But in the midst of those bookends about talking about the real Jewish history, I hope you see that the thing that really got us thinking a lot was, what's the truth that applies to you that's running through this? And it's huge. There's something you can learn from the travails of the Jewish people and from their efforts to rewrite their history and all that. You know, what all is behind that? There's something there for you to consider about what you have to face about your life. Like I said, I mean, eventually you've got to let go of all those things that you're falsely exalting in the outer life and do what Jesus said. Start with the inner life first. Start with religion, then get to politics, sociology, and economics. Not the other way around. All right, let's see what they have to say in this closing section here.
Section 10. the Hebrew religion. Their leaders had taught the Israelites that they were a chosen people, not for special indulgence and monopoly of divine favor, but for the special service of carrying the truth of the one God over all to every nation. And they had promised the Jews that if they would fulfill this destiny, they would become the spiritual leaders of all peoples, and that the coming Messiah would reign over them and all the world as the Prince of Peace.
Okay, so you can see how they're shifting gears. So when all is said and done, what have these Jewish leaders taught their people? They've set up the context that's in play when Jesus arrives. They set the wheels in motion so that things are as they were 2,000 years ago. With what Jesus had to try to deal with and all of their concepts of the Messiah and whatnot.
Right. When the Jews had been freed by the Persians, they returned to Palestine only to fall into bondage to their own priest-ridden code of laws, sacrifices, and rituals. And as the Hebrew clans rejected the wonderful story of God presented in the farewell oration of Moses for the rituals of sacrifice and penance, so did these remnants of the Hebrew nation reject the magnificent concept of the second Isaiah for the rules, regulations, and rituals of their growing priesthood.
Oh, boy. So the whole priesthood thing, and notice how it's so tied to the land. You go back to that same land, and it's difficult to not go back into that old priest-dominated, ritual-dominated mode. We talked about the real Egyptian bondage. Look at they're giving you the contrast between the two. So as you're getting towards the end of the five books of Moses, quote unquote, the book of Deuteronomy, you've got that beautiful, as they're pointing out, their farewell oration of Moses, kind of that hitting that climax of poetic recognition. You go through all the prophets, and you get to second Isaiah, and you hit the same climax of poetic recognition. And it just repeats itself. They can't really establish themselves independent of the land and of the past. Right? You know, have courageous and independent cosmic thinking.
Still today.
Yeah, and again, it's not just the Jews, the remnants of the Hebrews, or anything like they're talking about here. I mean, everyone has this same issue, right? In our own way, to find that courageous and independent cosmic thinking that stands literally independent. Right? The only reason that Amadon stood unmoved is because he had that, right? Because when all the outer life crutches are gone, right, you need something inside to stand on.
Okay, well, let's just say that I do all of this, have an independent inner life.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make the outer life go away.
Nope.
It doesn't make the evolution of the outer life change, at least not directly.
No. Right. I mean, and this is so. Yeah. For those in the webinar, he's saying, "Well, let's say I." He's saying, "Let's say I do this and establish the inner life. It doesn't make the outer life and all of its problems go away." Yeah. And actually, it can make the outer life all the more complicated and frustrating, because now you're going to really feel the tension. Right. The tension between your imaginary inner life and the outer life was bad enough, but wait, do you feel the tension between the real inner life and the outer life, really between ideals and the outer life facts.
And right? They say revel in disappointment, you get courage, all this kind of stuff.
Right.
What it does is it changes your view, the way you deal with it, so that that you realize that God gave you a mind. Figure out what you can do. You're this problem after that problem. If you don't have the problems, you don't grow, I don't think.
Yeah.
At least at this stage.
But I think one of the things he was getting at, yes, you can begin to deal with those problems much better than you used to as an individual. But, you know, we still wish that the outer life was better. We still yearn for the age of light and life.
In truth, okay? There are times when it is better.
Right, but the point I was just going to make is, you know, here's where you have to be patient. When enough people establish these inner lives, remember the fruits are automatic. And eventually, right, there's enough fruits that the outer life changes. Right? But the only way that outer life is really going to change for the better is by each person doing their little part, yeah? Which initially doesn't change anything out there. You know, it changes, improves the way you can deal with what's out there. But you know, eventually the fruits, there'll be enough fruits that things will change out there.
It unlocks your potential for opportunities for growth. Mm-hmm. In the new way that you're addressing things, mm-hmm. with your better perspective.
For you as an individual, even though the outer life doesn't change, you can get so much more out of the outer life. It's like it did change, you know, at least relative to you. And just how exciting that is to discover that, wow, I can actually get more out of the same material, right? I thought the only way to get more was to change the material. It's like, no, you don't really have to change anything. It does. You know, it's one of the things you have to discover is the outer life doesn't need to change right now. The outer life is exactly what it's supposed to be right now. Right? That's dictated by the whole. Right? But the outer life will eventually change when there's enough people with a genuine inner life, and the automatic fruits of those inner lives changes the outer life. All right.
National egotism, false faith in a misconceived promised Messiah, and the increasing bondage and tyranny of the priesthood forever silence the voices of the spiritual leaders, excepting Daniel, Ezekiel, Haggai, and Malachi. And from that day to the time of John the Baptist, all Israel experienced an increasing spiritual retrogression. But the Jews never lost the concept of the Universal Father. Even to the 20th century after Christ, they have continued to follow this deity conception.
The degree to which they follow a deity conception. So in other words, you know, temporally here, you've got a little bit of residual in the 5th century B.C., but by the time you get to the end of the 5th century B.C., is there alluding there between the lines? You've got a long time of, you know, relative darkness, as it were, all the way until John the Baptist. So, you know, it's a long time, from 400 B.C., until John the Baptist.
Well, here they're referring to the title of the paper, Evolution of the God Concept.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a bottom-up, what we have of God is a concept. The Jews have a concept of God that they have achieved. That's automatically mean they have a relationship to God, but they have the God concept.
Yeah, and just remember what they've done. You remember back with the prophets when they've, you know, pointed out, you finally had someone talking about the real God, right? And you know, and we saw them here commenting in kind of the more collective sense of them discovering something in contrast to social justice. Right. I mean, it's there. You've kind of embedded it in some written records and stuff, so people can rediscover it. But as they're pointing out, I mean, the people in general didn't hold on to it, but at least they kind of put it down as a benchmark, right, for others to reclaim. All right, here, keep going.
From Moses to John the Baptist, there extended an unbroken line of faithful teachers who passed the monotheistic torch of light from one generation to another, while they unceasingly rebuked unscrupulous rulers, denounced commercializing priests, and ever exhorted the people to adhere to the worship of the supreme Yahweh, the Lord God of Israel.
So that little paragraph, see, they're just trying, you know, forget about all of the sloshing back and forth and the, you know, the confusion and ignorance and machinations and whatnot. I mean, there's a thread of truth that kind of goes through it all, they're telling you there, just reminding you of that. That in midst of all that stuff, in, kind of in spite of themselves, right, things progressed forward.
As a nation, the Jews eventually lost their political identity. But the Hebrew religion of sincere belief in the one and universal God continues to live in the hearts of the scattered exiles. And this religion survives because it has effectively functioned to conserve the highest values of its followers. The Jewish religion did preserve the ideals of a people, but it failed to foster progress and encourage philosophic creative discovery in the realms of truth. The Jewish religion had many faults. It was deficient in philosophy and almost devoid of aesthetic qualities, but it did conserve moral values. Therefore, it persisted. The Supreme Yahweh, as compared with other concepts of deity, was clear-cut, vivid, personal, and moral.
So, kind of lacking in the beauty and truth departments, but, you know, the beginnings of goodness. See, that's what they had. And, you know, the degree to which that's genuinely there, okay, that's that little nucleus, right, that Jesus can encourage them to, you know, to hold on to and build relative to. If you've got the nucleus, you can eventually put the sphere of truth around it. Now, of course, you know, at the time of the writing of this book, right, all you had was scattered exiles. You know, but of course, in 1948, right, we established the Jewish state again. You know, so that's something that's changed, you know, since that was written. But of course, even with the Jewish state, there are still lots and lots of scattered exiles all over the globe. Yeah, because the Romans scattered them. And those they didn't kill, they sold to the four corners of the earth into slavery. But notice how they did the contrast between the conserving of the highest values and progress on the other hand, right? I mean, that's that tension between the progress angels and the religious guardians, the two groups of master seraphim. Right. And yeah, okay, sure, there wasn't a lot of progress, you know, in their culture that the progress angels could foster. But, you know, after all, between the master seraphim, you know, which group are the checkmates? You know, not the progress angels. They're the ones that need to be checkmated. All right, so yeah, again, that nucleus. Like I said, I mean, if you don't have the nucleus, you can't really have progress, for instance, right? So you have to conserve, you know, that nucleus, and the Jews provided that to the Western world, right? You know, that initial recognition of that nucleus, upon which you have the real God. And the beginning of the real you.
The Jews loved justice, wisdom, truth, and righteousness, as have few peoples. But they contributed least of all peoples to the intellectual comprehension and to the spiritual understanding of these divine qualities. Though Hebrew theology refused to expand, it played an important part in the development of two other world religions, Christianity and Mohammedanism.
Yeah, remember originally it was basically just Mohammedanism, and eventually you kind of had Islam coming out of that. Okay, so they loved justice, wisdom, truth, and righteousness, okay, but were clueless about what those really referred to. Right, again, because these, like we've said so many times, these thoughts come down into your head. Oh, it's like, oh, justice, truth. I mean, these thoughts just burn in your mind. but you have no clue what to apply those to. Okay, and so all of your initial application of justice, wisdom, truth, and righteousness is false. But you know, you're started with a burning passion for them, and you know, they found that burning passion because they, you know, they began to find that nucleus. But it takes that, you know, the fifth epical revelation, like we say so much, is about, you know, the intellectual comprehension and the spiritual understanding of these divine qualities. It's not just telling you there are such qualities. It's trying to get you to actually figure out what they are. Yeah. What is truth? Right?
All conscious.
All right.
The Jewish religion persisted also because of its institutions. It is difficult for religion to survive as the private practice of isolated individuals. This has ever been the error of the religious leaders. Seeing the evils of institutionalized religion, they seek to destroy the technique of group functioning. In place of destroying all ritual, they would do better to reform it. In this respect, Ezekiel was wiser than his contemporaries. Though he joined with them in insisting on personal moral responsibility, he also set about to establish the faithful observance of a superior and purified ritual.
Ezekiel did a whole bunch with that. We could spend an hour reflecting on that paragraph.
Because that is a good paragraph.
Right, but again, I mean, you know, we don't have to do this already. I remember, you know, my point is just to try to highlight some of these things. You need to spend some time yourself reflecting on this. You know, reflect on the tensions here of, you know, all the quote-unquote, you know, evils of institutionalized religion. Okay, and, you know, the fifth epical revelation for the first time tells you that genuine religion is a, you know, purely individual inner life fact, has nothing to do with groups at all. Okay, so even more so with this book, you could go off on this tangent they're talking about. But you, just because you establish a genuine inner life doesn't mean that you demonize or reject the outer life. Right? There has to be an outer life still. Okay, and evolutionary religion has its place. Right? Evolutionary religion is always going to be some outer life construct. Okay, but it's a special outer life construct that's predicated on a genuine inner life, unlike economics, right, or something. You know, one of the more definitively outer life phenomena. your ancient book readers have to always keep this in mind, there's a tension here. Between what everyone has always called religion and what is genuine religion, but it doesn't mean that you need to try to somehow go out trying to eradicate what has always been called religion, that outer life phenomenon, like they're saying there, right? You know, that outer life thing needs to be reformed. I mean, eventually. See, right now there needs to be science, philosophy, and religion. I mean, like I talked about, eventually, though, you don't have science and religion. And you just have philosophy, and you have the individuality aspect of philosophy, cosmology, and you have the unity aspect of philosophy, divinity. See, you have cosmology, philosophy, and divinity. And so you don't have that evolutionary religion, but that's only way down the road, right? Until then, right, you know, that genuine religion was purely an inner life thing. Okay, you know, you're not going to have that. You're going to have an evolutionary religion, right, that's not really religion, right? Hey, okay, but it's an important human institution that needs to be there for a long, long time until every mortal has an inner breadth and depth and integrity that we can't even imagine right now. Okay, so that's what they're wanting you to think about, is that tension between that purely existential inner life and the evolutionary necessities that are all tied to the outer life.
Okay. You'd be hinting at some physics here with this description of technique of group functioning.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, you know, that's an indispensable, it's almost, how they're couching that.
Yeah, and that technique of group functioning, we'll get into some, when we get into the five religion papers here not too long, we'll actually get into talking about some of these things. So you're not going to really leave this paragraph behind. We'll actually talk about it more in the context of them talking about kind of the physics of religion and group religion and all this sort of stuff. Okay.
And thus, the successive teachers of Israel accomplished the greatest feat in the evolution of religion ever to be effected on Urantia. The gradual but continuous transformation of the barbaric concept of the savage demon Yahweh, the jealous and cruel spirit god of the fulminating Sinai volcano, to the later exalted and supernal concept of the supreme Yahweh, creator of all things and the loving and merciful father of all mankind. And this Hebraic concept of God was the highest human visualization of the universal father up to that time, when it was further enlarged and so exquisitely amplified by the personal teachings and life example of his son, Michael of Nebadon, presented by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
Speaking of Nebadon, yeah. he knows of that which he speaks. Just that little tie-up. You've got to love the way they described it, the fulminating Sinai volcano. I mean, and just, you know, be honest with yourself. Is there still not a part of you that would stand in awe of of massive explosions and thunder and lightning and... Yes, that, you know, that God of justice and power and right.
Yeah, welcome to storm chasing.
Yeah. All right. So, it's reminding you between the lines, you know, that there's a part of you that wants to serve that God, and that's not going to change in this life. But you want to add the part that has an affinity to the creator of all things, the loving and merciful father of all mankind. Okay. Add that inner life to that lower domain part of you that's tied to the material and the outer life that, you know, thunder and lightning is pretty cool stuff. And awe-inspiring, right?
About to, well, there is creation of a sort going on there, but not straightforward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same thing with the allure of fireworks.
Yep.
Display of polish.
Yeah, and even see calling it the barbaric concepts. Again, like I'm saying, you know, the best you can have savage and barbarous with the lower domain. To get civilized, you need the upper domain. You need an inner life. Right? No matter how tender the feelings, it's really just fancy barbarism. Right? That's the thing. That reflective life that's transcendent of feelings, that gives you that genuine human that's civilized. And is beginning to foretaste the era of light and life. Right? Can actually begin the process with the quest for knowledge and wisdom, you know, and proceed from there. Okay, so that's kind of what's between the lines there for you in that final statement. All right, so, wow. See, that was these last couple sections in this paper are just so massive. I mean, it takes two full kind of over-length sessions to even get through them.
One of the longest papers in the book.
Yeah, it ends in such enormity, the way this paper. Okay, but we made it through. So we've got this, the final paper, paper 98. You know, we haven't dealt with the greater issue of the Melchizedek teachings in the Occident. You know, so we've got to go through that. We'll start that next time. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.